Hello everyone, Justin here with the Gear Priority Podcast, and I hope you're ready to get slightly nerdy. Today we're going to dive deep into why barefoot training might be a life game changer, and talk about the best approach to start barefoot training and what not to do so that you can avoid injuries. I'm here with Chase Tucker. Chase is a corrective exercise specialist for hikers and reluctant gear reviewer. His words, not mine. Over the years, Chase's advice and exercises have helped me dial in my training and recovery and were essential when I was hiking 37 kilometers a day, day after day for 36 days on the Great Divide Trail. I think Chase pretty much stands alone in the hiking community for the quality and applicability of the advice that he provides for hikers to maximize their body's performance while on trail. Welcome, Chase. Anything you'd like to add to that intro? And are you a reluctant gear reviewer?
Yeah, I do have a bit of reluctance when it comes to gear, but the first thing I want to call you out on is that you just doxed my name. I don't think people know my last name, but now they do. So
we can bleep it out if you want.
A lot of people don't even realize that my name is actually Chase. So my channel name is Chase Mountains, and a lot of people are surprised to learn my name is actually Chase. So yeah.
Do people think your last name's Mountains or
no? Who knows, man? I'm sure some people do, but maybe I'll change it one day. Maybe I'll legally change it to Chase Mountains. We'll see.
Nice. And just to confirm, you're okay if your last name is so okay. I'll throw a marker here. The editor can remove that little bit there.
No, leave it in.
Sounds good. And all right, so we're gonna start off with some rapid fire questions just to warm things up, get to know you a little bit better. Starting with the first one, what trail is the number one spot on your hiking bucket list?
Okay, well, in terms of, I have some stuff that I'm planning, but I guess the one that people would know is the trail that goes across Corsica, the GR20. And, you know, we have lots of GR hikes in Europe, but yeah, that one goes across Corsica, goes one side of the island to the other, over some pretty decent high mountains, like some really nice alpine terrain. So that is that's on the list.
Nice. Is that island just off, like west of Italy?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. In the Mediterranean there.
Yeah. East.
So somewhere in there.
somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's in the middle of the Mediterranean.
Yeah. Awesome. So, and what's your favorite snack on trail?
Well, I like dates with a bit of peanut butter on top. Sometimes that's tricky to arrange, but I have like a little container where I bring my peanut butter and I get medjool dates and dip them in peanut butter. And if I'm feeling real fancy, I'll add chocolate.
That adds a little bit of fancy factor to it. What's the most distance you've covered in a day when backpacking?
I think it was, I clicked over exactly a marathon. So 42.2 kilometers. I think that's the longest that I've done. And that's just the one that came to mind because I was thinking, you know, oh, I'm getting really close to a marathon here. And at the end of the day, when I set up my tent, it was bang on 42.2 kilometers or like 26.2 miles or whatever it is. So I think that might be my biggest day.
Was that in the mountains? Like, because I think you hike in the Pyrenees.
Yeah, so that was actually, my plan was to cross a country in a day. So I crossed Andorra and yeah, so I started on the west side of Andorra and I finished on the east side of Andorra and it ended up being a marathon. So I crossed the country and did a marathon over the mountains in a day. And that was a really memorable, like, yeah, beautiful day.
That's awesome. That's good. Yeah, it's nice to have those memories. And this next question might be bit of a tougher one. Maybe you may need to think on it a bit, but if you could give one piece of gear to every backpacker going out on their first trip, what would it be? Something that you think backpackers maybe they don't bring often that they probably should be, or something that you're just like, this is a piece of gear that's amazing that every backpacker should have.
This is going to be a controversial one, but I'm going to say like bring a trowel so you can dig a hole, because I know a lot of hikers don't dig holes, and like sometimes as well, I don't dig a hole. Like if the ground's soft enough, you can figure it out with like a trekking pole or whatever. But especially for beginners, you know, just handing them a trowel, they would immediately be like, "What's this for?" And then I could explain that it's not nice for hikers to come into, you know, a populated area and just see like toilet paper everywhere. So that I would go with that.
That's a great answer. I think that's the one I was thinking in my mind too. And it kind of brings us into the last rapid fire question here. Toilet paper or backcountry bidet?
I've never used a backcountry bidet. I'm not opposed to it. I think like in Europe, we're a good couple of years behind everything that happens in the States or in the Americas. So I wouldn't even know where to find one of those. I'm sure I could get one online, but for the sake of the question, I'll just stick with toilet paper for now.
I think like they have the attachments for water bottles, but I forgot mine on my last trip. So I just used my smart water bottle. And as long as you're not trying to like get a, because they're a little bit different than like a toilet bidet where it's kind of shooting a stream at the target there.
A bum gather. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the way I use it is I drip water from the above so I can just use a regular water bottle and it works out pretty good. But the cleanliness you get, especially on a longer trip, is unprecedented. It's pretty phenomenal.
It's a good thing we're going into detail and stuff. Welcome to the podcast, everybody.
Yeah, that's it. There will be some future podcasts about pooping in the woods. I'll probably bring on Miranda goes outside. She could talk about poop.
Miranda's all day. The expert when it comes to that stuff.
I don't want to call her the poop queen, but maybe try and get that to stick. But the topic today, we're talking about barefoot training. And as I was putting together this podcast, the first thing I kept running into was questioning myself on whether the correct terminology is barefoot training. Is it minimal footwear training? And like what's the terminology that most people use or what is in this like science and literature? Like what is being used out there?
Call it whatever you want, man. The term that everyone uses, most people use, is barefoot shoes or barefoot footwear. But then you have people will comment on my videos and say like, well, this is an oxymoron. How can you have a barefoot shoe? And it's like, okay, that's obvious. Like we know that, like you don't need to point that out, but that's problematic. So you could also call it like natural footwear or just minimal footwear. Like there's many different things. And, you know, to be honest, I don't think there's a scientific term because there's not a lot of science that's carried out on natural footwear or minimal footwear. Yeah.
Okay. I like natural footwear too, but I think most people are probably familiar with barefoot. And something that I want to talk about a little bit is I think from a training perspective, the footwear isn't necessarily essential for that. And I know I've watched a bunch of your videos. You have a lot of great content on barefoot training. You a lot of the time you can just do that barefoot. You don't need the barefoot footwear in order to be doing that.
Yeah. If the environment that you're in is like some gyms won't allow you to be barefoot. And that's a big reason why I started training in barefoot shoes, because the gym wouldn't let me go in there with no shoes on. But yeah, if you have that option, that's the best option because you can see what's happening in your foot. Like maybe you can't always pay attention to what's happening in the foot by watching it because you're doing other stuff, but it is really helpful to actually see the feet and that can teach you a lot, like just watching the metatarsals move and all the muscles kind of contracting as you're lunging, squatting, deadlifting, whatever. Yeah.
I think maybe we can kind of jump back a little bit as far as for people who aren't familiar with barefoot training. I think we kind of just hinted at it a little bit there, but what exactly is barefoot training?
It's as it sounds, I suppose, but like the important thing is that regular shoes, first of all, they're offering like cushion and support, and often there's a heel rise. So the height, the stack height of your heel is often, you know, 5, 10 or 12 or more millimeters higher than the forefoot. So that presents problems biomechanically when you're doing exercises like lunges and deadlifts and any other exercise you do on your feet, right? So the footwear that you're wearing is impacting your movement and your biomechanics. So my perspective is that where possible, people should be training in either barefoot or you know, wide, flat, fairly neutral shoes, unless being instructed otherwise by a podiatrist or any other qualified health professional.
Okay. Yeah. And I think we'll get into a little bit later, kind of what components make like a good piece of barefoot footwear. But I think I'll probably want to pick your brain a little bit about the medical field and their approach to feet, because I think I've gotten some weird advice from doctors in the past about footwear, and maybe we'll jump into that. But something that I guess who should be caring about barefoot training, like is it specific people, is it only athletes, or is it everyone out there?
My first thing is that if you're a parent, you should be caring about barefoot footwear, because a lot of the damage that is done by modern footwear, a lot of it is hard to repair or irreparable once you get to a certain age. Like once you're 55 and above, these things get very difficult. The body struggles to regenerate tissue and restructure things after, well, even say after 40. So the best thing you can do for your kids is to get them in wide, flat, flexible, minimal shoes. So if you're a parent, you can do your children a great service by never putting them in shoes that restrict the foot, especially the toes. So that's the first thing. And the secondly, like when it comes to athletes, athletes are very adaptable humans. And when we look at the feet of athletes, they're often very dysfunctional. Like have a look at Usain Bolt's feet. He's got really mangled, like hallux valgus, like the big toe is pointing inwards. He's got like huge bunions, really mangled toes. And up until recently, he was the fastest human on the planet. So we don't have to, you know, criticize athletes for the way that their feet look, because they're already outperforming all of us. You know what I mean? So this is more about the individual and what the individual needs and what their goals are.
And that's interesting about for children and babies. Do they make barefoot footwear or yeah, more like anatomical footwear for children?
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
that's cool. I'll have to keep that in mind.
It's probably a little pricier than the average footwear, but you know, and that sucks because kids need new shoes all the time, right? But it's really an investment in that child's health, their, you know, only their biomechanical health, but because of the way that the foot operates, and because I like to think of the foot as a sensory organ, and it is. It's like if we had a sixth sense, our sixth sense would be proprioception, which is our ability to perceive space. And a lot of that comes down to the foot itself. And if you're dumbing down the foot brain by, you know, putting a very cushioned, very restrictive shoe on it, then we're going to lose a lot of that sensation as we grow into adults. So I think that's the most important part of this barefoot conversation, is like a lot of the damage that we've done ourselves is too late for a lot of people, especially when we're older. But what we can do is prevent more damage from happening in the future. And that starts with kids.
Okay. Yeah, that's great to know. And you mentioned Usain Bolt. If you took him who grew up with kind of barefoot shoes and more anatomically like sound footwear, you think he'd be faster than the current current Usain Bolt with kind of mangled feet?
Oh, that's a good question. I think probably not, because he would have adapted to, like, there's a certain mechanical advantage that comes with a lot of the like really fast, you know, athletic running shoes. There's no doubt about that. So yeah, it's a tough question. I'd probably say no.
But, okay.
You know, yeah.
So we'll get into some of the maybe some of the benefits of barefoot footwear here. But I'm curious to hear kind of what led you to incorporate barefoot training, and like how many years have you been doing it, and what brought you down that journey?
I probably would have started around 2011, 2012. And that's kind of when I had a big shift in my life, when I got out of like the corporate world and I moved into health and started my journey as a personal trainer. And I started with the idea of training hikers. Like I didn't want to just, you know, train people to get muscly and fill out their shirts. I was really focused on hiking from the beginning, and hiking is obviously, you know, related to the feet. And around this time, a lot of people will remember the Vibram Five Fingers debacle, where they were making some extraordinary claims about the benefits of using the footwear. And, you know, Chris McDougall's book just came out War to Run, really good book. Like, if you're interested in the barefoot thing, I would recommend reading that. And so it was all over the headlines, and it was a big deal. And because of these claims that were made by Vibram, Five Fingers, you know, they resonated with me because I had limited ankle mobility, I had knee pain, I had lower back pain. So I was like, I was in the gym as a, you know, a functional training specialist who was experiencing all these biomechanical problems and had busted up knees. And that put me in a very, you know, difficult position because I felt that I wasn't deserving of being a strength coach because I wasn't the perfect biomechanical specimen, you know? So it resonated with a lot of the messages that were being, they were and still are, you know, false claims from Vibram Five Fingers. And whilst I didn't buy that particular shoe, I think I started with like New Balance Minimus or something like that. And I just started wearing them in the gym in the hope that those benefits would come to me. And sadly, they didn't. And I didn't experience any negative side effects from wearing barefoot shoes, but it certainly wasn't, you know, what I was hoping to happen. Let's put it that way. So that's kind of how I started.
What were those claims that Vibram, was it, because I know I remember hearing, like, when I first heard about barefoot training, a lot of it was like, it was kind of just like, go barefoot all the time, every day, and it'll change your life, basically. And
there was five things in particular that they claimed, and this is like point of sale stuff that they had in stores, right? So they had five reasons to wear or train in Vibram Five Fingers, and they brought it down to number one was strengthens muscles in the feet and lower legs. Let's unpack that real quick because that's true. Like, there's some truth in that, right? But the question is, like, which muscles and in which foot and in which human? Because every single foot is different. Even your two feet, like your left and right foot, are completely different. So that foot is going to react differently to that change in footwear. So, you know, you can't say that those changes are going to be necessarily beneficial. Yes, there will be some increase in strength in the muscles in the feet and the lower legs, but are those changes going to impact you positively or negatively? Like, it's way too broad. Like, you can't claim this kind of stuff and get away with it. And they didn't. Yeah. So that was the first one. The second one was something like improves range of motion in ankles, feet, and toes. I think toes probably that's a fairly valid claim. Feet. Probably not. Like, you can't, again, you just can't survey broadly feet because there's 26 bones and 33 joints there that we're talking about. So again, way too wide. And then when it comes to ankles, that will also depend on the human. And in my case, you know, I had relatively stiff ankles and limited mobility, and I didn't see any increase in mobility from wearing barefoot shoes. So that's the second thing. Third was that it stimulates neural function and improves balance and agility. This one I would sort of agree with, like, could potentially improve your balance and agility. That's like semi-legit. And stimulates neural function, certainly, because we're having more stimulus from the ground that we're walking on. So I would say, like, tick the box on that. The fourth was eliminates heel lift. So that's the stack height that I was talking before. Eliminates heel lift to align the spine and improve posture. So the huge claim there, you know, now we're talking chiropractic. You can't claim that, especially when you're looking at God knows how many different types of feet and how many different humans. It's impossible. That's a real sketchy one. And the fifth and final one was allows the foot and body to move naturally, which just feels good. And that's nice marketing language, but I guess it does allow the foot and body to move naturally. But then again, like, what is naturally? it's hard to determine that. Like, the important thing is here, if you're taking humans that have been in supportive cushioned shoes for 20 years, and then you put them in this Vibram Five Fingers shoe, it's already used to moving in a certain way. There's ingrained movement patterns for the last 20, 30, 40 years or whatever. And then when you change those patterns overnight, problems happen. And that's why I made the video that I did and put on YouTube, because it's not that the barefoot shoes are causing the problem. The barefoot shoes are fine. It's what's happened before that that's important. And that's why I think, you know, starting with kids is the place to start.
That makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of those claims, those five claims that you laid out, I definitely heard all those, and I still hear them and see them out there, especially in marketing materials from different companies who may be making barefoot footwear. And I think that kind of brings us to, like, if those are the claims that companies who are making barefoot footwear were making, and some still are, what, and a lot of those benefits aren't necessarily true, what are the, like, the scientifically backed benefits of barefoot training?
That's a tricky question, because there may be some independent studies probably paid for by, like, barefoot shoe companies, maybe. But I think, you know, any research that's done, that's paid for with a, you know, an interest in mind, is always very tricky to use as absolute truth. So that's the first thing I would say. And secondly, even if you are looking at, like, certain populations that have similar feet, everyone's situation is going to be wildly different, and how they react to certain stimulus wearing a barefoot shoe, people are going to adapt differently to that, not adapt at all, or they're going to experience a negative consequence. So I don't even really pay attention to research on this stuff, because every foot is wildly different. And if you wanted to really take a scientific approach, you should take that approach yourself by, like, testing, assessing, implementing a plan, and then retesting. And that's the only thing that's worth doing, in my opinion, scientifically.
Yeah, so keeping it more working on individual by individual basis to see kind of what, how to incorporate barefoot training, and then see if there are benefits that are coming about from it. And so are there people out there, like you kind of mentioned, that some people just might not adapt to barefoot footwear at all? So is it other people out there just won't see any benefits from it?
Yeah, so if you're, like I said, if you're sort of 55 and over, and I don't mean to be kind of, like, ageist here, what I mean when I say, like, 55, it's more like your biological age, because I've met dudes that are, like, and women who are 80 and who are absolutely crushing it, and they're biologically a lot, like, younger than that. And, you know, the other thing is training age. Like, if you've been healthy and moving and exercising for a long period of time, then your biology is going to be much better at adapting to certain things. So when I say something like over 55s, don't take that too heavily. But certainly there is evidence to suggest that after 55 in general, like, you're going to struggle to adapt to certain things. But I don't think there's any, like, there's lots of different foot functions, and certainly some of them would represent their individual challenges, and it may indeed be possible to not adapt to barefoot shoes. I'm sure that exists. But as far as, like, listing them and saying, if you have this particular condition, like, your chances are zero, I'm not aware of any of those, because our bodies are so incredibly intelligent and so good at adapting that I think almost anything can be overcome with the right approach.
I guess from anecdotally, when I first came across, and it was, a lot of it was through your channel, was for barefoot training, and then I really took that to heart when I was training for the Great Divide Trail. I had issues with plantar fasciitis for a while, as well as some IT band issues, and I found that the barefoot training, it pretty much eliminated any plantar fasciitis that I had in my foot. That's just kind of, like, who knows if that was correlation, but is that a benefit that people can see from barefoot training, like, alleviating some of those things?
For sure, yeah, that's very common, but probably equally as common for people to experience symptoms that, you know, they start getting plantar fasciitis because now they're wearing a barefoot shoe, and, you know, the foot is having to work a lot harder, so there's more stress on the plantar fascia and the underlying tissue underneath the foot, and that may cause problems. Or it might be happy days and like your biology reacts perfectly to this. And so, you know, the only way to do that is just like, just go and try it out. And if you have a negative response, then it's not like throw these shoes in the bin, I'm done with this, like write myself an article in Vox about how barefoot shoes are bullshit. Like, it's going to be different for everybody. And if you are willing to put the time and the effort and the intensity, and if you have the inclination and the interest to work with your foot and the muscles within the foot, and, you know, do half an hour of work on your foot every day, then you can get your foot back to 100% functional and perform way better and enjoy a great life having a really functional, intelligent foot, rather than just throwing the shoes in the bin, calling it a, writing it off as a waste of time and money, and then just going back to shoes that are inherently dysfunctional that probably going to continue to take you down the wrong path, or what I would perceive as a negative pathway.
So that's what I've heard a lot of people that I've mentioned barefoot training to, the exact scenario that you just outlined happens. They try them maybe for a week, their feet are in pain, and that's partly on me for more just kind of probably seeing it just off just putting it out of the wind and not really providing much guidance to it. But I think one of the issues that I see is people treat it more of like a lifestyle change than a training change. And I know like I wouldn't go out in order to train for running, go out and run a marathon after not running for like 36 years. And should people be looking at barefoot training in a similar way? Like, don't go out and just start all of a sudden wearing barefoot shoes all day, every day. Should they be stepping up? And like you said, like half an hour a day kind of thing.
Yeah. This is where people run into a lot of issues because they don't really understand the biomechanics, and they just throw a new barefoot shoe on and start living their lives that they, in the exact same way that they used to, with a supportive shoe. And yeah, that presents problems, and we can talk about transition strategies and that kind of thing. But I also just wanted to like pedal back a bit and say that, like, if you don't have the inclination to do those exercises, that's also fine. Like, not everyone's going to have an extra half an hour, 40 minutes in a day to do these like crazy toe exercises, like toe yoga, and, you know, to be manipulating your feet and all this kind of stuff. It's just a personal preference, and I'm here to tell people that there's a lot of benefit in doing that if you want to go down that path. But no judgment if you don't want to do it. That's totally fine. I understand it. It's like crazy.
Definitely, and I think it can be a lot to especially like half an hour just on your feet. People could probably see that as being a lot of time out of their day. But
for sure,
is.
Yeah. Sometimes just half an hour to train your whole body is pushing the limit for people that have kids, and, you know, they've got stuff going on, they're already stressed. Like, adding me saying you have to do half an hour of foot bicep curls every day is like, it's not going, they're not going to react well to that. And like you said earlier, it's like a lifestyle thing. And that's kind of what I enjoy about the barefoot world, is that it does align itself well with, you know, eating well and exercising and training and getting outside and hiking, and it's great to see that there's actually hiking specific sort of barefoot shoes now, which is also great. Yeah.
So you mentioned like kind of working on the transition. I think that's when I was transitioning into using barefoot shoes more often, that seemed to be an important component, because I had switched to zero drop shoes at one point in time. That was actually the trigger for the plantar fasciitis that I had. I went on a really long multi-day hike with them, and my feet hadn't adapted in any way. So if people are trying to incorporate barefoot, and maybe there's not a correlation there, but if people are looking to incorporate barefoot footwear and training into their life, what are the steps that you'd recommend for making that transition?
The first step this is the funny thing that I hear about Americans all the time, and I have been in the States, but it's a long time ago and I can't remember, but apparently Americans wear shoes in the house. I don't know. I know you're not American, but you're close by.
Yeah. So, so they wear shoes where?
Like in the house. They wear shoes in the home.
Yeah.
So the first thing would be like, be barefoot at home. That doesn't require you to go out and buy anything. Just spend a little bit more time barefoot, in socks, just walking around. Like, you don't have to wear shoes all the time.
That's a big one, I think. Because you're right. A lot of people in the U.S. and not so much in Canada, but still a little bit here, people wear shoes inside. And because it's so cold here, people wear very supportive slippers as well. So even if they're not wearing like full on like running shoes inside, they're still wearing supportive footwear. And I think that, like you said, like just kind of eliminating that could be a good first step.
Yeah. So being barefoot more often in general. And like I said earlier, if you are hitting the gym, and if your gym allows you to do that, like be barefoot in the gym, or if not, get a barefoot mammal shoe, and just for like 4 weeks, keep your barefoot footwear just in the gym, because you're going to be applying some stimulus, walking around, using them a little bit. It's going to be a very safe and conservative way to start giving the body that stimulus. Over and above that, you should, in the next 4 weeks, start to incorporate like 20, 30 minute walks, ideally not on like hard concrete around the city, because that's already pretty tough. So if you can get onto a soft trail, 30 minutes a day or every other day, that's going to be wildly beneficial because of the different stimulus that comes from that trail. And eventually you can increase that time and start doing other activities. But it's really about very slow implementation. If you make big changes, that often results in big problems.
Yeah, I think that's awesome advice. And I know it was tempting for me when I got my first pair of kind of barefoot training shoes that I was using in the gym to just take them out for a long run, but I kind of resisted that. And even once I did start using them for some runs, it started off as like only being able to go out for about a kilometer. And that was after building up my walking, using them while walking out for walks with the dog and stuff like that for a period of time. So I think that's great advice, because you kind of hinted at a little bit, there's like people can run into some issues if they don't take that structured kind of slower approach to integrating barefoot training. Are there any other, like what are the risks, I guess, with that? Like what issues might people start seeing?
I mean, one of the most common that we've already mentioned already is like plantar fasciitis. That crops up a lot because of everything is changing biomechanically in the foot when you take away that support. So that's a big one. And often these two things are related, but also people will experience a lot of calf tightness, and they there's an obvious reason for that. It's because the heel is the same height as the forefoot, right? So let's say if you've gone from a 12 mil drop to a zero drop, that means the calf and the Achilles and all the posterior tissues have to adjust 12 millimeters. And every step off, every time you heel strike or midfoot strike and toe off, there's more demand placed on those tissues. So of course the calf's going to tighten up. And what we can see is that if people have like if their problems aren't too bad and they have a fairly functional foot, those things will kind of balance out and rectify a little bit. But equally as often, people just start to accept that having super tight calves is just part of the barefoot world, and it's not. I experienced this personally, and every time I would run, I would have really tight calves. And you can foam roll your calves till the cows come home, but if you continue to wear barefoot shoes and you don't identify the dysfunction that's happening within the foot, then you will continue to have super tight calves. And foam rolling your casket, it's not going to change anything. And for anyone that's there's loads of reasons for that, by the way, but for anyone that's kind of struggling with that, I would say look at the rigidity in the midfoot. Can you evert and invert your foot to the degree that it's functional? And the best place to go and find that out is look at blackboard.com. Blackboard is like a little training tool that I have, and it's just like a really simple like piece of plywood. Like, you could build one if you had a garage and some tools, and that's just a wildly beneficial way to start training your foot in all of the different planes of motion that it can and should be able to move in.
Okay, yeah, I definitely experienced the tight calf issue, but it resolved itself. So is that just due to my foot mobility also? Like you kind of just mentioned, like the foot mobility improving as using the footwear as well.
Yeah, it may be due to that for sure. Like, you, I guess you were like lucky in a way that your biology adapted to the stimulus and it all worked out fine. But for a lot of people, that won't be the case. But these are all just like, this is the interesting part of going down this path, because you can observe what's happening, and then you can test and experiment, and you can do a quick Google, go to YouTube, look at some exercises, try them for 4 weeks, and if you get a benefit from that, like, you're onto something, and you can, like, it's a really cool, interesting pathway to go down, because you, like, it's like a game, you know, it's like an experiment with yourself. So this is all about kind of like being your own scientist. And as I said earlier, some people are going to be into that and some people aren't, and it's there for you. Like, there's so many resources to learn from.
Yeah. Like you said, if people aren't interested in being their own scientists, I think that's when maybe it'd be a good idea to bring on a personal trainer and someone to kind of be that scientist for them. Is that a lot of what you see yourself doing? Like kind of being that scientist for people and providing that perspective?
I mean, there's better people than me to do it for sure. You know, I come from this as an interested party and someone who has experienced these things myself. So, you know, I can speak to that experience, but I'm not a podiatrist, you know, I'm not a foot expert. And so, like, what I generally recommend for people if they want to learn more about their foot is that they find a natural podiatrist. And the key word there is natural, because a lot of podiatrists, if you're listening, guys, I love you, you're great. And there's good podiatrists and there's slightly lazy podiatrists, right? And I think that you could say that about lots of different medical professions. But what has happened in the past and what is unfortunately common is that a podiatrist will assess your foot, see a dysfunction, jam some insoles in there and ship you off and say, hey, good to go for the rest of your life. And for me personally, my opinion is that that's not restoring that person back to optimal health. That's not improving the dysfunction of the foot. That's compensating with a piece of foam underneath the foot. And what happens when that piece of foam isn't available, or what's happening to the foot as a result of that piece of foam being there? Like, the view of the barefoot community and my view is that we should be restoring, where possible, optimal foot function. And if you go and see a natural podiatrist, with any luck, they'll assess the foot, identify a problem, and be like, yeah, we should see improvements in this in like 6 weeks by training your eversion or reversion, or, you know, increasing the mobility of the big toe, which is often like a really simple thing that people don't think that a big toe could be a problem until you see an expert and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good to know, especially the natural podiatrist. I've had friends who have had foot issues. They went and saw more of a traditional podiatrist, and they did exactly what you said. They built a $300-$400 custom insole for them, and then put that in their shoe and said, you're good now. And I think what that kind of triggered in my brain, I've had like I've sprained my ankles a lot during soccer, and for a while I had to wear a brace around my ankle, but eventually I ran into a physiotherapist who told me to, like, I need to be strengthening that ankle and not just bracing it all the time. And that's what would help out with that. Is that like kind of a similar approach? Like, is an insole like that? It's just kind of bracing the issue, but then not, because of that, it's not allowing you to strengthen and build proper foot function.
Yeah. The analogy that's used all the time is like, it's putting a cast on your foot. So if you break your leg, they put a cast on your foot because they don't want you to, you know, do the damage any further. But what happens when you have a cast on is the muscles atrophy because they're not working, because they're not working to stabilize themselves. And it's impossible for them to strengthen because they're not moving. And the same thing happens when you put an insole for a long period of time, an insole that isn't being retested and adjusted with the aim of getting you back to a optimal function. The muscles within the feet are going to atrophy. They're going to get weaker because they're being supported by this exterior, you know, support and structure. So yeah, that's one analogy that you could use, but it's basically a band-aid, and it's doing is it's solving the symptom, but it's not solving the underlying problem. And as long as you're aware of that, that's cool. That's fine. Like, you continue to go and hike and do whatever you want with your insoles because it's limiting your symptoms and it's getting you out of pain, which is a tick the box. That's great. As long as you understand that it's a temporary solution to a permanent problem, unless you address the dysfunction.
That's great. And I think that kind of leads into my follow-up question to that, which I think you kind of just alluded to there, was if do insoles have their place, and kind of like a hybrid approach, that can that work? Like if you are going on a long hike, that, you know, in the past might cause you some foot pain, like just dropping an insole or using a thicker, more cushioned shoe for that kind of acute time in order to alleviate symptoms. Like that's okay, but it's good as long as you're kind of understanding that you're just treating the symptoms and you're not actually, like, you should probably still be doing some barefoot training if you want to be able to push that time before the symptom kicks in.
Yeah, not necessarily barefoot training, but yeah, you should be understanding the situation that you're in, understanding the dysfunction of the foot that you're experiencing, and yeah, if you have a big hike coming up, then it's likely you won't have time to, even with the best advice and the best person helping you, might not have time to get back to optimal health. In that case, like, an insole is going to be something that can temporarily help you get through that, tick the box, get the hike done, hopefully without pain. So they're very useful in those circumstances for sure.
And if someone wanted to start incorporating, let's say someone has a hike and they're hiking maybe like the PCT or like one of the big long trails, or even if it's like a week long trip and they want to get their foot into a healthy state, what's the minimum amount of time that, and understanding everyone's different, the minimum amount of time that people should probably be starting to look at starting to train their feet or work on their foot health, if it's something that they're just starting to do? Should they be leaving about like 3 months for that, or?
It's probably likely even more. 3 months is like a bare minimum, maybe six. And not to plug my stuff too hard, but the reason why I program these certain exercises the way I do, the way I demonstrate things in a lot of detail, and the way that I integrate foot strength training into just regular stuff like squats and lunges by doing it in a specific way, is because we can start to get those benefits even before that person has discovered that they have like a foot dysfunction or any kind of foot issue. Like, you're naturally going to become stronger from doing these particular movements when done under the right circumstances. And I think, like, what I'm trying to do is get people to, you know, by the time someone has like a really serious foot dysfunction, it's a little bit too late for me to address that concern, and they need to see a professional. Like, I'm a strength coach, I'm not a podiatrist. So what I'm trying to do is get people to understand their feet, start training their feet and looking at their feet as just as important as the quads or the calves or the hamstrings, especially hikers, and start to build strength and rebuild an optimally functional lower body from doing those exercises. And that's the best I can hope for at the moment.
Nice. So your programs, and I think we'll put some links in the show notes to the different resources and stuff that you have out there. Do your programs are they kind of in that six month range then, or do they have like a time length?
I've got a 4 week one. I've got like a 3 week. I've got a 3 month one. I just recently released an annual program, so it's kind of like, in that program, it's called Cornerstone. I'm representing, it's the closest thing to what I do throughout the year. And I don't really adjust my training to a big trip as I'm thinking about going on a big trip. I'm not like ramping things up. I just keep it at a pretty moderate level all throughout the year, because I've never really, since I've been doing that, I've never like got out into a trail and think, oh, my quads aren't as strong as I potentially could be, or my cardiovascular capacity isn't what I wish it could be, because I'm just cruising at this very moderate level. Like, I'm not an athlete. I don't expect the people that I work with to be athletes, unless they want to be. And that just means that I can do whatever I want at any time, basically. And if I wanted to climb Everest tomorrow, I could. There's no drama in that, within reason.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've read some of the books out there of like training cycles in order to hit peak performance at a timed part of the year and stuff like that. But yeah, I think for most people out there, that's maintaining a steady ability is probably more of a priority than
for sure
to hit like one event for 1 week or something like that.
Yeah, sometimes that timing, like getting that timing right, is near impossible because life happens, right? And, you know, things, you know, you get a spanner in the works and things can go south. Like, my approach is like, adjust this to your lifestyle and like live a good life and bring training into your life and make it an important thing and get interested in it. And then you won't have to worry about peaking and tapering and all this kind of stuff. Like, I don't program that way because I don't want people to be like coming to me and saying, I've got 3 months to do this. Like, I used to do that and I found it very frustrating, because what would happen is that like 6 months or 6 weeks into that program, someone would get plantar fasciitis or they would bust up a knee doing something silly. So I had to pivot. And I had to reframe my training as lifestyle stuff to get people to enjoy training as part of their lives, not as something that's like, oh, I'm under pressure because I've got this trip coming up and I need to be fit. And since doing that, we've had exceptional results with people, just lifestyle-wise, happiness, health. You know, the longevity thing is something that I'm constantly repeating on my channel. The consistency thing is something that I'm constantly repeating on my channel, and because that's the most important thing. Like, if you're not consistent, peaking and tapering and none of that matters, because you didn't do the work in the first place. If you do the work in the first place, probably you'll be in a really good position and you won't have to sit up at night crunching numbers about how many kilometers you've walked, whether that's like the right percentage of. When it comes to running, that's a different thing. Like, I'm not a running coach either. Running coach is all about volume and tapering and all that kind of stuff. I stay well away from that.
Yeah, for hiking, and I think a lot of people, most people probably aren't training, and you probably see this with your clients, they're not training. Like, a lot of them want to be hiking multiple times, maybe a year, and then hiking for a long period of time in their life. So that longevity is a key component. They're not looking to retire, be a professional athlete, then retire at 35 and
Yeah, it's a very different approach. And the reality is that hiking is not a performance sport, and I'm well aware of that. And I like just being able to enjoy myself throughout the year, and I like to just have a good reserve where I know that if I can push harder or faster, if I want to, I can. But also, I'm not going to sacrifice my lifestyle to become like this hiking athlete when the reality is that that's not a thing.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anyone who's out there who's a professional hiker. Maybe some of the FKTers or something.
This is the thing, FKT is, it's a thing now, but you know, I mean, anyone serious about doing an FKT is running. So it's a different sport.
They're a professional, stay awaker, almost more so, staying awake for 72 hours and being able to move while hallucinating, I've heard, is one of the biggest hurdles with FKTs.
It's a big advantage.
Yeah, exactly. But I wanted to just
professional sleeper is just deprivation.
I wonder if there's coaches for that out there. I just wanted to bring it back to just if people are looking for barefoot footwear, because I think we kind of mentioned some of the features of barefoot footwear, but if people are looking to pick up a barefoot shoe or piece of barefoot footwear for training, and like if their gym doesn't allow them to train without shoes on, what should they be looking for in order to accommodate that?
These are the kind of questions that I can't answer. So I'll give you a broad.
Yeah, not specific brand or anything like that, but
what to look for, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So in order of I don't think we went through what constitutes a barefoot shoe, but I'll go through it real quick. Basically, a barefoot shoe is wide such that it allows the toes to splay out. It's flexible so that you could literally grab it and twist it. Like a barefoot shoe will allow you to do that. It is thin, meaning that, you've got maybe 4 or 5 or less mil of very thin foam underneath your foot and some little bit of tread and not much else. Also that it is flat, so it's zero drop, no difference between heel height and forefoot height. So they're the main things. And when you, I guess the important thing is for someone who wants to transition or start dipping their toes in the water with this stuff, is that it doesn't have to be a black and white approach. You don't have to go straight to a barefoot shoe. What I generally recommend is start by getting a wider shoe, something that allows the toes to splay out naturally. And the reason why is because a lot of people have, as a result of wearing dysfunctional shoes, have claw toes, hammer toes, internally or laterally pointing big toes, and they present a lot of problems upstream, not just in the foot, not just in the ankle, but all the way up to the hips. So that's the first thing to look for, wide, very ample toe box. And if necessary, getting toe spacers to help correct the toes so they are in line with the metatarsals. And that's the main thing that modern narrow shoes don't provide. So if you tick that box, you're already winning.
Mm. And those toe spacers, they're kind of just something that you just stick between your toes in order to kind of spread them out a little bit.
Yeah, it's like a little silicon glove kind of that you put over your toes, and it can be uncomfortable at first. And you can get ones that are designed by podiatrists that are specifically designed to you to correct, especially the big toe. Or you could just buy generic ones off Amazon, which allow you to, they encourage a little bit more space for the toes. And that's obviously not the best approach, but it is a way that you can encourage the toes to splay out naturally. When the toes splay out naturally, a lot of those benefits, or one particular benefit that we talked about earlier, increased agility and balance, that's going to happen because if you imagine with your hand, you're going to be more stable on a wider surface. So if the toes are spreading out, you're automatically going to be able to, firstly, you have more contact with the ground, and then hopefully if the toes are strong, and as they get stronger, you're going to have more agility and balance. So that's probably the first thing that I would look for. You don't necessarily have to go straight to a beer for
sure. Okay. Yeah, that's good to know. I think getting that wider toe box, and then like you said, having that zero drop and then minimal cushion. But what would be the second thing out of those three? Would it be going to something with like a zero drop?
I'd say probably the next thing would be like lowering the heel drop over time. Don't go from 12 mil drop to zero. Like, look for shoes where you can slowly sort of ramp that down a little bit. That would be the next thing. But again, you don't want to do that overnight. That will present issues likely.
Yeah. So it's a balance of like kind of lower, moving towards like a lower drop, lower cushion kind of over time. Or kind of just, if you're going to go jump right into like no cushion, no drop piece of footwear, you probably then are going to be having to limit the amount of time that you spend in that piece of footwear.
I guess, yeah. So there's two ways to go. You could gradually change your footwear, or you could gradually increase the load and the intensity and time that you're spending in the shoe. So it's the two ways to do it.
That's awesome. That's good info for people. And I think there's a lot of different brands and pieces of footwear out there. I'll probably throw a couple options out there for people if they're interested in the show notes. Anything else before we kind of wrap things up, Chase, that you just want to make sure that people out there who are interested in barefoot training or want to get into it, that they should know?
Yes. So there is, if you are interested in this and you want to go down the path, like I said, the stuff that I put out there, a lot of the time you'll see me training barefoot, and you know, that is like a blanket approach to like just generally get better. If you have, if you think that you've got a particular limitation and you would like to explore that, then there's loads of different channels on YouTube that are like foot specific, and they're natural podiatrists, and they're putting out loads of good information. Just be aware that things might get worse before they get better. Any exercise that you implement should be implemented for a minimum of 4 weeks. And just like, stay positive and don't give up. Like, there's no use just doing an exercise for 1 or 2 days and just being like, oh, I don't feel any better, because of course, right? Like, be a scientist, test, implement something, retest. And that way you can start like crossing off these boxes. So, okay, that didn't work. Oh, I got a little bit from that. Maybe that is indicating to me some dysfunction in my foot. You can shortcut all this by going to a good natural podiatrist. But, you know, I enjoy the process of learning this stuff. So for me, you know, if you want to look at some of what I consider like the best in the business, My Foot Function, TFC, the Foot Clinic, Barefoot Strength. They all have YouTube channels, and they're like great. Not only is it entertaining content, but like, these guys are legit. They know what they're doing. A lot of the time they're like structuring things for certain dysfunctions, and it's wildly helpful if you're interested in it. So that's what I would recommend. But yeah, most of all, just stay positive and, you know, keep the dream in mind that you're going to be hiking when you're 80 and 90. And I really hope that for the people listening, that's the reality for them.
That's awesome. And I think that's what I always really enjoy about your channel is the positivity, but then that genuine kind of, exactly what you just said, that you want people out there to be hiking until they're 80. And that really comes through. If people are interested in checking out your YouTube channel, that's Chase Mountains. They can just search that, get in there. And then if they're interested in personal training stuff, where can they go to check that out?
My website is chasemountains.io. Yeah. And the thing that I always recommend people, if they're like new to my stuff, go with Elements, because firstly, it's the cheapest program, it's the shortest program. So like, it's a low investment, and you're going to know within like a week or two whether you like my stuff or not. So that's where I'd start.
Awesome. Yeah, and I'll have links to all that stuff in the show notes. Thanks for coming on here, Chase. And I think we'll have to have you on and talk about some other aspects of training for hiking, because I think as much as hiking's not a professional sport, I think, like you said, being able to hike tier 80, you'd got to be doing some stuff other than just going out for a hike once a week, I think, or once a month.
Yeah, the main thing is you're interested and that you're passionate. And if you can reframe, if you're not into exercise, my advice is if you can, you know, reframe that into like a positive thing. Like not everyone in the exercise world is about building muscle and looking as ripped as possible. I'm certainly not. So, you know, find your people, find your guru and enjoy the process.
Awesome. Thanks, Chase. And we'll talk to you later.
You're welcome, man.